This is the Studio Alchemy Podcast, episode 115, an interview with Tori Shendel Vyvoda. Our quote of the day was said by Hildegard of Bingen. Like billowing clouds, like the incessant gurgle of the brook, the longing of the spirit can never be stilled. Hello, everyone. The purpose of this podcast is to explore creative ways to transform our lives. Alchemy was the ancient study of changing materials from one thing into another, and we all do this every day. Every choice you make is transforming our world. On this podcast, we hunt for the wise balance between accepting what is and taking empowered action. My name is Addie Hirschton. I am an artist. I teach art classes and I've written a few books, including The Alchemy of Art: Stories for the Classroom, The Alchemy of Painting: Developing Your Style and Purpose, Start Selling Your Art: A Guide to Starting a Professional Art Business, which is available on Audible, and my latest book, The Alchemy of Symbols: How to Use the Power of Images to Transform Your Life. To find out more about my projects, classes, and to sign up for my art newsletter, I invite you to go to my website, studioalchemy.art. So today I will be interviewing Tori Shendel Vyvoda. She is the curator of the Evansville African American Museum and director of the La Mosca Micro Gallery. She earned her bachelor's from Indiana University and a master's from Johns Hopkins University. She's pursuing her PhD at the Institute of Doctoral Studies in the Visual Arts. Also, she is an arts collection researcher at the University of Southern Indiana, an adjunct instructor at the University of Evansville, and a former visiting faculty member at Harlaxton College in the United Kingdom. She was featured on two PBS documentaries for her research on Evansville's Black history. Tori is also an active artist who exhibits her artwork regionally. So you can find out more about Tori at torivyvoda.com. And now for my interview with Tori. Tori, welcome to the show.
Hi, Addie. Thank you for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, what is the story of how you became an artist and a museum curator and PhD student? And I mean, really, you do so many things, which is, of course, that makes you an exciting person. So that's why we're chatting here today. But how did that all come about? And maybe even, you know, what's going to come next in your journey?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I'm definitely all over the place. And for a while, sometimes it would make me sad because I didn't have a specific focus. I think that sometimes we get so detailed and embedded into our Western thought that we have to pick one thing and stick to it. But what's been fun, and why this is a timely question, is I'm actually working on a publication that dives into the diversity in liberal arts trainings. At the end of the day, everything that you just mentioned does fall into the education of the trivium or the liberal arts. And I've always had a connection to creativity in the arts. And I've always liked to do art. So although I'm getting a doctorate, I wasn't always a good student growing up, particularly through K-12. Sorry to my former teachers, and thank you for continuing to believe in me. But art in German really got me through middle school and high school. And then when I got to college, it just exploded from there. I was lucky enough to attend IUPUI, Indiana University, Purdue University of Indianapolis. And while there, I decided to embark on becoming a medievalist. And from that decision, which is what the article that's going to come out soon that's focusing on, and trying to understand the why, well, when you want to study the medieval period, you have to know the individuals, the people, the history, the culture, the language. There's so much holistic learning that goes into studying the medieval era that you have to dive into so many things. And while I'm still trying to better understand the why in it, because of that background and because of my training, I've been able to apply that holistic learning to curation, to getting back into the arts as being an artist. So thank you for the opportunity. And a doctoral thesis or dissertation, I mean, and doing more work that is, it seems like it's all over the place, but really when you look at it at the point of view of a liberal arts person, it all makes sense. And just to quote my colleague, Dr. Kisha Tracy, in her book, Why Study the Middle Ages, she specifically discusses how when you look at previous publications from the era, all the top scholars were saying it's important to study everything, not just pick one, but study everything. And if you want to specialize, of course, go for it. But those overlapping multidisciplinary areas is what's going to make you a better scholar and also just a more thoughtful person. I think that's what we want to be at the end of the day, more thoughtful, critical thinking people. And that my liberal arts training and all over the place studies allow me to do that. So whenever an opportunity comes, if it falls in something that seems passionate and important to me, I'm going to do it.
Okay, I just thought of an on-the-fly question. And I thought to myself, you are a Renaissance person. You know, because there's that saying, oh, to, you know, be a Renaissance man is a person who wants to have their hand in everything, you know, just to be a well-rounded person, like Leonardo da Vinci, for example. But you're in the medieval era with your studies, and I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on being a Renaissance person and that saying, or maybe there's a difference between the medieval era and the Renaissance era in terms of the way people viewed an ideal such as this.
So thank you for that question. And of course, it strokes an ego to some degree to be called that. So deeply thank you for that. But more seriously, it's fun when you think about the term Renaissance and how we define it. And of course, our Italian friends defined it as a rebirth. And I think when it comes to looking at it more as a rebirth than an era of time, it's amazing that all these new endeavors turn into micro births of something new and something exciting that you can then intertwine or interconnect to the things that are already happening that I'm doing. For example, I'm working with Dr. Meg Hagseth. She's from Dallas College, and we're actually creating a digital video of one of my white papers about Hildegard. And so we're talking about the intersectionality of gender, religion, and Hildegard, which is very medieval, but we're creating a complete video, like digital humanities experience. Like you see on BBC, you hit a button and it plays a 10-minute video that goes into that with individual shots and all sorts of beautiful creativity. So it's just adding another seed to plant to really tell that story through, I think, more of a lens of a rebirth than Renaissance, looking at it from an Italian point of view. At least generally speaking, when Renaissance is used, I think that's the first that's used. And with that in mind, I just think it's important to experience all that you can. If you want to use the term, I won't say no, because that's pretty swell. And at least when I think of Renaissance and applying it to my work, it's more of that rebirthing and creating new beginnings to create a more holistic understanding so that we can get back to that trivium, which is a very important medieval ideology of how we train as academics and scholars, but also as just people of the world. We have a right to learn, and we should be learning so that we can put our critical faculties to good use and be critical thinkers.
So you've used that word trivium a couple of times. I mean, I'm assuming you is in three, or what? What does that word mean?
So when using that word in a medieval context, the trivium refers to the curriculum in which a young apprentice or scholar would be undertaking when they would go to university. So like rhetoric, logic, philosophy, the reading of multiple theologians as well as classical Greeks. So it's more of a curriculum base. So thank you for having me define that as well. Speaking of definitions, but I'm using Trivium in the medieval context of holistic learning.
Cool. I've already learned something. okay, so you recently went to Europe to study Hildegard von Bingen. For our listeners who don't know about her, what's her story? What drew you to her story? And I want to hear all about the epic journey and what you learned.
Yeah, so I appreciate that question because Hildegard is near and dear to my heart. And I first learned of her by studying at IUPUI and taking classes with Dr. Jennifer Lee. And from there, I read Jeffrey Hamburger's book, Nuns as Artists. And that was it for me. Hildegard has been my BFF for the last 14 years. And so in regards to studying Hildegard, I study her whenever I can. I try to bring her voice into whatever I'm doing because she is a Renaissance woman, to use that rebirth term. She did a little bit of everything. And what was really fun about being in Europe, which I'll get to that point, was getting to study 21st century in 20th century, and then figure out how that applies to Hildegard. And really, that's what I was doing out there, is studying and learning and trying to figure out how I can bring her into the modern light to make her still relevant and to show why she's so important. And so I'll share a little bit about Hildegard, and this actually comes from the paper that I wrote while in England and Scotland and New York. And right now it's being considered for a paper prize, so fingers crossed. But thankfully a journal editor reached out to me and said that she would pick it up regardless. So it will live! It will live somewhere. So so here's a little bit about Hildegard. So Hildegard von Bingen, 1098 to 1179, was the founder of the first abbess of the Benedictine community at Bingen. As one of the most captivating spiritual figures in the 12th century, a substantial corpus of her writings still exists as original or facsimile. And from hundreds of letters to emperors, popes, archbishops, nuns, and nobility, 72 songs, including a mortality play, which is considered an opera, 70 poems and 9 books, Hildegard's mark on the theological world has never dissipated. In addition to her writings, Hildegard preached throughout the Rhineland, including Cologne and as far south as Switzerland. She even preached in Paris, and whenever she lectured, church leaders either recorded her sermons or asked for and received copies of her works. Hildegard was a superstar theologian whose fame attracted over 50 sisters to join her community, which led to the creation of Hildegard's second abbey at Ebingen in 1165, which still operates today. Hildegard's impact on the female and male spiritual community is well documented. In addition to Hildegard's abbeys, writings, and community, she was considered a prophetess because of the mystical experiences she had experienced since she was a child. Curious about her authenticity, Pope Eugene III, in the Council of Bernard de Clairvaux, demanded that Hildegard's mystical writings be reviewed. After their investigation, Hildegard not only received papal approval, but was encouraged by the Pope and Bernard to keep writing. As a papal-approved prophetess, Hildegard would not have only been studied in the Rhineland, but her official writings gave her the authority and voice to scribe the female spiritual experience for those even outside of her abbey to have access and reflect on. Hildegard's most profound publication was the massive trilogy of Scivius. And Scivius is a book in which Hildegard's unique visions were recorded through texts and images. Published in 1141, the manuscript was created because a voice from heaven commanded Hildegard to document the prophetic visio dei, or divine visionary experiences she had experienced since childhood. As she explains at the start of her book, which was inspired by her admiration for Saint Benedict, Scivius focuses on the fundamental virtues of humility, obedience, and discretion. Supported by her monastic contemporaries, such as the Reverend mystic Bernard of Clairvaux, 1090 to 1153, Hildegard completed Scivias in 1151. And 8 centuries after the completion of Scivias, scholars such as Barbara Newman and Jeffrey Hamburger note that Hildegard's compelling work still renders a dynamic array of interpretations. Her Ignatic manuscript is unique to monastic theology and gives insight into female spirituality, history, monastic art, and medieval science. And this is why I am unbelievably captivated by Hildegard, because she is definitely a Renaissance woman.
If you were to pick one idea from all of Hildegard's writings, which of course is just in and of itself so impressive. So she just did so much. There's a real passion behind a lot of it. Is there one key concept or one line that you go back to and you say, oh, that's my favorite. I just love that.
Absolutely. And it's definitely, though, been mediated by Dr. Reverend Matthew Fox, who's a mystical scholar himself. And the via creativa, or that creative evolution, that immense love that each one of us get to experience in a profound feminist way. There's multiple visions, but particularly Book 1, Vision 1, where she goes into Hildegard, where she goes into that creative love that each one of us get from a divine creator. Now, of course, through her lens, it's a Christian God through the Benedict. But the cool thing is, it's a love that can be expounded to be more universal. There are multidisciplinary writings that discuss the via creativa that you see in monastic cultures be used in Hinduism, Buddhism, and other theologies and belief systems as well. Now, that I'm learning, I don't know a whole lot on, but it's amazing to see this community grow and be more inclusive. And while Hildegard being a Benedict, Matthew Fox being a Dominican, and then Tori just being Tori, we have those feelings that there's something here, there's something that inspires us, and we see it in our artwork, we see it in our writings, and we feel it. And when you can get to commune together and have these discussions, that's what brings 11th, 12th century mystic to life in the now, in the 21st century, because I would assume Hildegard had those same feelings, which is why I really do appreciate your book about symbols and the discussion of archetypes, because I do think there's something fundamental to that human experience, that different viewpoints, different people, different cultures, different religions are reflecting on and showing through their creative via creativa, through their creative evolution.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so I just got to ask you the play-by-play of your epic journey to Europe that you just did, and, you know, what museums did you get to visit? Were there any documents, like, did you get to touch any, well, they probably gave you the gloves, but did you get to, like, touch any primary documents, like things that she had written on, or what did you get to see and what did you learn? So that basically I can live vicariously through your vacation. Well, you worked, so I don't know if we could call it a vacation, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because it's interesting. There is, in my opinion, a value in ontological experience. And to define that, it means experiencing a phenomena or an event in the present. And so getting to be in, I went to England, I went to Scotland, I went to New York. And why those places are important is one of the facets I'm trying to better understand is Hildegard's Celtic roots and how her Celtic identity impacted her as a Benedictine nun. And I don't have a formulation for that yet. And so while I do study Hildegard quite a bit, and again, Dr. Reverend Matthew Fox talks about her Celtic and writes about her Celtic experience and how that influenced Scivias. So I'm trying to better understand that first. And that's why I'm spending more time going to the Celtic regions, better understanding the artifacts on display, like at the National Scottish Museum, the British Museum, Victoria and Albert Museum, Gosh, there were so many. Even just going to Hampton Court, too, and experiencing other facets of medievalism to just draw some inspiration. But what was really fun about that trip was particularly going to Scotland and understanding the Celtic influence there, because I want a more holistic understanding of the Celts in general. And I have studied the Celts on and off for years, and I thought I had a good understanding. And that's where it's important when you're able, and if you're lucky enough, to be in country, talk to scholars, talk to people, visit the universities, visit the professors, visit the curators, see the artworks, and then check yourself, because what I realized is I had a completely wrong interpretation. And again, going back to that trivium, I do need to put more time into studying the Celts and even the Scottish medieval period, because there could be some hidden nuggets in there that I never considered. Like I said, I thought I knew a better, I won't say an expertise, but I thought I had a better understanding. And when I got to go there and actually look at the artifacts, look at the archaeology, talk to people, I didn't know anything. So, I need to do more homework, and it's exciting, because that's one thing I love about this job and this strange profession and embarkment of trying to know more. You're never going to know it all. Yeah. That's not even possible. But you can know better, and that's where I'm at right now. I'm using these experiences to know better, and I'm excited to apply the knowing betters to the works of Hildegard, because I really do appreciate learning from Dr. Evan Matthew Fox, and it would be great to better extrapolate those teachings with the artifacts, with the historiographies, and merging them together. Now, for this trip, I really didn't get to touch any sexy artifacts per se, but I have to say this, when I was up coming up to Studio Alchemy the first time, I was heading to the Medieval Academy of America conference at Notre Dame, and they had a facsimile, an approved facsimile of Scivius that I got to touch, and I just cried. Those were actual tears. And so getting to see the facsimile of something you study, because the original copy of Scivius was destroyed in World War II, unfortunately. Oh. So luckily the nuns, sticking to their monastic ways of the scriptorium, did make copies. So there is an official written copy of Scivius, but the actual original that was in collaboration with Hildegard and Vollmer, that's gone. So luckily we do have these official copies in circulation that have those touches and have the communities embedding into the document or the trilogy itself. So, and just having that was just, I can't believe I was here in Indiana this entire time. I never knew.
Wow. Okay, so this is a language question, because I love linguistics and took a class in college that was Middle English. So we learned Middle English, and you probably did the same sort of thing at some point, as if it was a foreign language, and it was fascinating, and I loved it. But I'm assuming, too, that if you're reading Hildegard's writing, and this would be some sort of a earlier form of German, how different is it? Did you study it the same way I studied the Middle English?
So the cool thing is, I can Occam's razor and say that Scivius is written in Latin.
Oh, that makes sense too.
So super easy on that one. However, though, what is cool about Hildegard and her Latin texts, and why I was in Europe too this duration, was working on a paper to critique Rainer Schurmann's Broken Hegemonies book. And really the premise of the paper, that's hopefully being considered, so fingers crossed, viewers, for the paper prize, is the fact that Schurmann uses language of different eras to show phantasms, and he's trying to create these spokesmen more particular, of how language can not only shape an epoch or an era, but then how did it decimate it as well? And for Schurmann, he elected Meister Eckhart. Okay. Now, Meister Eckhart is phenomenal, incredible Dominican prophet that I do recommend everyone reading and studying, because he believed in communal learning. He worked very close with the Benguin women's movement and also the mystical Rhineland movement, to the point that he actually got condemned by the church 2 weeks after he died, a week or two, sorry, don't quote me on that, but at least a week or two after he died, to be a heretic because he worked so close to the women. And he even said on the record that some of his men were trying to be too self-important, and he couldn't understand how these men are allowed to have access to theology, the Bible, and preach in a way that they are, but these women aren't simply from their gender. Oh. And in fact, I personally believe that if Meister Eckhart could read Rainer Schurman's book that was published in English in 2003, mind you, with the eradication of all women's voices, I think that Meister Eckhart would be completely angered at Rainer Schurman for giving Meister Eckhart sole credit for the female spirituality that he learned. And that's where language is important, because Rainer Schurman, in chapter 11 of the book, uses German, Middle Hochdeutsch, is what we call it, Middle High German, vernacular German, and Latin, to prove that Meister Eckhart is the spokesperson for the Latin era. And I'm like, no, it was communal. I'm not against Rainer Schurman writing an entire 1,100 pages about trying to understand Western epochs through language, through a male lens. I don't have a problem with that. What I have the problem of is he's making it seem that only the males had the right to write that history. Only males had a voice. And Schurman had access to Hildegard's works. He had access to Marguerite's works, another female mystic, to Mechthild's works, another medieval mystic, because Matthew Fox, who I keep referencing, actually published the same time as 2 years off from Schurman, and Schurman is referenced in Dr. Reverend Matthew Fox's book, Breakthrough Meister Eckhart. So these were active choices to exclude the women voice, and it was an active choice to not do a call for action, because I do believe specialists have a place and we need them. If his specialist is the male dominant voice, okay, that's fine, but use it in an inclusive way. Don't say that's the ultimatum. That's my problem. And so I wrote this huge paper going through language, going through linguistics, German, German vernacular, and Latin, to show that Meister Eckhart just perpetuated this philosophy but was not the originator, which breaks down a work that was published in 2003 through Indiana University Press. That's a big deal to me. So it's a very good question for that reason. Language matters, and we definitely need to reflect on it so that when we're presented with information, we're not appropriating literally the written word of numerous women before Eckhart.
You know, then from what you're telling me, like everything that Hildegard did that we have is all in Latin?
So I know the majority of her writings were in Latin. This is where I need to dive more into the archive of Hildegard, which, yay. And I need to go to Eibingen. I am working with a few sisters to better understand the archive and what is there from Eibingen, and they're so unbelievably kind. So if you do have a question, I definitely recommend reaching out. I've experienced nothing but kindness, and these sisters don't know who I am, and they don't care. They just care about spreading the good word of Hildegard, which to me is holistic yayness. Yay! I know, and I'm pretty sure I'm referencing Margaret Fassner's book, but I could be pulling this out. But I'm pretty sure that there are German works or German letters that she has. I think that there are German records from Hildegard, whether in original facsimile, but I think that is true. But I do want to at least correct myself on this, because it's a recording that I would have to double check. So if someone's inspired and wants to double check me and write in the comments, that'd be great.
Yes, I think isn't it Socrates who said something about, you know, the only way to truth is to doubt. So you have to, you know, just check and make sure with everything, which is, of course, the best scholarly way. Yeah, and it strikes me, too, that just, you know, the work that you're doing and studying Hildegard is for you on a personal level, you know, you're able to hear her voice, you know, through the writings and everything. And then you're sharing it with other people, which feels like it's like, oh, I'm spreading the love, you know. And I'm wondering, are there other artists from that era that we should know about? Or, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking about, for me, when I went to art school, I don't remember Hildegard von Bingen being mentioned at all. I also didn't hear about Hilma af Klint, who, you know, that's a more modern artist, which of course you love. She just made it like lovely face, like, yay. But I didn't hear about either of those two characters. And I think this is a great example of, in the academic world, if we're not sharing a diverse range of stories, then those stories are lost and they're not held up and they're not being learned from. And then, of course, we're striving to find those characters and those voices again. Are there any others that we've missed?
That's a great question too, because I will say one of my blessings was discovering the medieval period, or it discovering me maybe. And once I had this aha, like, whoa, this period is absolutely fantastic, I would spend most of my Fridays and Saturdays and even just downtime at the library, grabbing every book off the shelf, opening up, reading it, learning the authors, and going down rabbit holes that way. Even after I graduated, I took 5 years off between my undergrad and master's. Fear of debt, you know. But I would still go to the university libraries. At the time, IPFW, Indiana, Purdue, Fort Wayne, Valparaiso University, when I lived there. And then I moved back to India, just kind of moved around Indiana. But wherever I was living at the time, I would at least ask permission from librarians if I could have access to the university library and just read medieval books. And that's where I would spend most of my time. That's where I felt at home and the most comfortable. And so having the blessing of self-teaching is how I think I got to really reinforce and dive more into these narratives, because there's only so much a lecturer can do or teach. With that being said, it is important to make active choices so we don't end up echoing Rainer Sherman's mistake. And with that being said, Hildegard has never dissipated from the theological world. And so even when I'm at medieval studies conferences and hear that, well, Hildegard's never talked about, sometimes I forget that is the reality because I'm so used to her in my vocabulary. So of course, Hildegard is one. Mechtild is another big mystic that I would highly recommend. Her writings are just absolutely phenomenal. I don't remember if she has illustrations that go with her visions or not. And there's also, again, Julie of Norwich. She's just an amazing, amazing mystic who existed during the bubonic plague. And while church officials and leaders were saying that this is God basically telling us that we've been living a bad life and he's going to take it, Julie of Norwich always found the positive way through a theological lens and a mystic lens to talk about that. So she actually wrote in Middle English, so that's a good one. And then Hedwig, she's a poet who wrote 42 stanzas, and she talks about the creative spirit and creative evolution. And there's a great book by Elizabeth Dreyer, I don't remember the title at the point, where she does actually parallel Hildegard Scivias to Hedwig's poetry. So that's a new way to look at art, or think about art. And those are just the big ones that are on my mind. But there's many, many women, artists and philosophers and theologians that we're trying very hard to give a breath of fresh air to, share their stories, share their visions, so that when any teacher at any level is making those hard choices as they're creating curriculum of who to include, who not to include, it would be great to see an increase of women. It would be great to see an increase of diverse voices in general, of course, but there are so many opportunities to indulge into the material. And I think, to go back to, I guess our theme is Renaissance, I think it's a very exciting time right now to be a medievalist, at least from what I'm seeing now after 14 years of being or going back and forth with being a medievalist. I'm seeing far more collaborations, call to open access, and call to working together in ways I haven't seen before. And it's creating beautiful partnerships to be more inclusive, to have marginalized voices at the table. I've seen so much more literature about Africa being published and being included. Dr. Aki's work with Africa and Byzantium, she's a medieval curator at the Met, and the catalog and the exhibition she just finished and released has just been spectacular. Ethiopia and Crossroads, which is coming to Cleveland, I think in a month or two, if it's not already here. We're taking the kids and going. But just to see those medieval narratives too changing. Or when I got to study at the Roman Baths on fellowship, we were asked in one of the first lectures, when you think of Roman, what do you think? And of course, the white guy with, you know, all the armor. And the curator said, well, this is actually the Romans. And it was multicultural. And so she's even trying to break down, you know, those embedded or those embedded misconceptions we have of not only what's medieval, but also what's classical. And so it's just a really fun time, I think, to be having these conversations, exploring, and really trying to focus on that inclusivity, because it's important. It's a holistic story. And the more holistic we get with this story, we can take away that nasty term that medievalists hate called the Dark Ages. There was nothing dark about it. They had color too, I promise, you know. The cathedrals were painted, yeah. I digress on that one. And that's what makes this so much more fun. And when you ask about who to include, there's so many more narratives, individuals, and I can share more than what time allots, but those are at least some of the bigger names. And then just looking at the medieval period more holistically instead of just the European lens, there's way more nuances and lightness to it. The Light Ages, which is also a good book. So thank you for that question. Yeah.
Okay, one more question that's about this academic medieval stuff. You know, definitely playing off of what you just said, I'm curious, I mean, we know that there has always been trade between all the countries of that central part of the world. But then, of course, that means ideas are traveling as well. But it's so hard to pinpoint an idea, you know, an idea that might have traveled verbally, word of mouth, from China all the way into Germany and touching upon Hildegard or her ideas. Do you have any sort of a sense of how much, this is such a vague, big question, I know, maybe it's not fair, but any sort of a sense of how much communication was being had at that time about philosophical ideas or religious ideas?
Absolutely, and that is a fair question because, yeah, because specifically when focusing on trade and ideas, there's a couple books that I would definitely recommend that further explore these ideas and actually have more concrete evidence of the sharing of ideas, what that meant, particularly in a global medieval context. So Dr. Brian Keene, phenomenal medievalist. I mean, I bought every book that he publishes. But one of the volumes that he edited was Global, I think it's called Global Medievalism or Global Middle Ages, thank you. And it's from the Getty Press, I'm pretty sure. But Brian King, Global Middle Ages, the book will pop up, and it actually specifically goes into trade ideas, how that reflected in art, manuscripts, and these trading of knowledge banks and how that happened. So that book is fantastic. Another book by Dr. Keene, Balthazar, the Black King, he has a specific chapter on trade and how the African kings were prominent in the dialogue of Europeans, mm-hmm. and how that has been, that history and that nuanced aspects have been just eradicated, erased, or not celebrated and it's been credited to Europeans or Romans. Mm-hmm. Dr. Aki, Andrea Aki, who I just mentioned, if you buy her catalog for the exhibition Africa and Byzantium, it talks about trade specifically. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how we modern scholars have appropriated African culture, cultural heritage ideas as Roman. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of her exhibition and the publication, is to reattribute those stolen narratives back to the Africans who were the originators. Mm-hmm. So I would love to get on their level. I'm still a doctoral in training, so it can be done. There are books out there. And the cool thing is they're not written in heavy jargon. It's written in an accessible way that you could pick up the books and just read them without having a PhD. So I'm really grateful for that too. Because the whole goal is to show that this is a complex, highly diverse period of time that most of the population, due to us not being good stewards of the information, publication, or accessibility, think it's just this dark period of white individuals. So I definitely recommend those books. They can eloquently and have the artifacts and the step-by-steps methodology to show how we've been able to accredit and re-accredit, reattribute ideas. And even Dr. Reverend Matthew Fox in Illuminations of Hildegard von Bingen, in the introduction, he even talks about the cultural share and ideas in a very easy to digest way too. Mm-hmm. So the scholarship's out there. These books are relatively new. I'd say the last like 10 years or less. So this is why I think it's the renaissance of the Middle Ages, because we are finally putting this information front and center, easy ways to digest and access, and even in different venues. And so Dr. Aki's exhibit is traveling as well. So it's a fair question.
Very good. I try to be fair, you know, but, you know, sometimes I throw curveballs, so... All right, so final question. So I've recently written a book on symbols. What's your favorite symbol and why? If you can narrow it down to one.
So if you want to talk about unfair, I think that one's unfair. And so I think when it comes to symbols, it definitely is mood dependent. And so it's one thing that's fun is with your book, and at the moment, my favorite symbol is the egg. Mm. And in your book you say an egg is an oval shaped object that safely holds the embryo of birds and reptiles until the baby is ready to hatch. Eggs are often watched by the parents of the offspring in a nest built to gently contain them. Eggs symbolize springtime, youth, possibilities. And with that being noted, what's really cool about symbols and their archetypes, which is also explained in your book, is when we go to Scivius, first off, Hildegard's work is just saturated with many, many, many symbols. But one of the coolest ones at the moment that's captivating is called the cosmic egg. And when you see the cosmic egg in Scivius, it literally is an egg shape. And according to Hildegard, the illumination of this egg cosmos is the universe itself. And what's really beautiful about this egg, Hildegard's rich image of the universe as an egg. First, an egg is a unity, a whole. This is a basic truth of the universe that Hildegard insists on time and again. She writes, quote, God has arranged all things in the world in consideration of everything else, end quote. Just as in an egg, all things are interconnected for the sake of the whole, so too in the universe. And so that's an expert of Scivius, and it's also an expert from Illuminations of Hildegard von Bingen by Matthew Fox. And just thinking of the egg in all these different manners and different ways, and how you're describing the egg as something that's more earthly, and that still connects to what Hildegard's saying, so I love that connectivity. Mm-hmm. But then Hildegard says, look at the universe, this is our egg. And to have a different way to understand science, particularly through a feminist medieval lens, and have that connectivity and that archetype come through, I think it's just absolutely beautiful. So I'm really inspired by the cosmic egg. I'm also reading Margot Fasser's book about the cosmic egg and how she's scientifically diving into the medieval science of how the universe is thought to be through the lens of Hildegard. And she's creating a 360 dome video experience that we got to test at Notre Dame and see. So that's coming out soon. And it's just amazing that this one archetypal feature can mean so many things to so many different cultures, and it can be used in so many ways to talk about either just the birthing of a bird to the birthing of how you and I are here today.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Tori, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity.
This concludes the Studio Alchemy podcast. May these thoughts and stories comfort and heal your spirit. May you be filled with inspiration. May you be like the lotus flower and build your home in the muddy water. May you find your voice.